Okay, I was summarizing material on AD 30 to 590, so I want to finish that today and announce that we'll have our test on AD 30 to 590 tomorrow. And so, here we go. Regarding the Godhead, we have the teaching that the doctrine of the Trinity is the result of the discussions of Christology at the first four church councils. Because of how Trinitarians defined Jesus, they ended up teaching there are distinct divine persons. This came from Logos Christology, which was originated in Alexandria, Egypt, in the second century. Logos Christology taught two things. The Logos is a person. The Logos pre-existed. This Logos Christology split into two streams, Arianism, which denied the deity of Jesus, and Trinitarianism, which affirmed it. In the West, the most influential and successful proponent of Logos Christology was Tertullian. Now, we didn't talk about Tertullian in this regard, but he was a teacher in Rome, and he was the first man to use the term Trinity. He did not mean what a modern Trinitarian means by Trinity, however, it appears. Nonetheless, he's an early Trinitarian, and he did believe in Logos Christology. Now, there were some other errors besides the Trinity that came in, such as Montanism. Montanism was a 2nd to 4th century movement emphasizing speaking in tongues and abstinence from worldly practices. We also have priesthood. The term priest was first used to the Christian clergy in AD 200. And then we have a progression through Callistus, Augustine, Leo I, and then Gregory the First, the real Pope. Relative to the development of papal power, we have the Council of Chalcedon, 451, which defined Jesus as one person with two natures. And they said the Patriarch of Constantinople was guaranteed equality with the Pope and full jurisdiction over the Eastern Church. This shows us that even as late as 451, there's still no Pope. And it also means that these church councils decided issues that you and I disagree with and that most Protestants disagree with. Now, you and I also disagree with their Christology, but most Christians don't. The fact that they made these other decisions, though, I say, proves that the council is void of authority. If it has authority, then this pronouncement is just as authoritative as the other one on Christology. Then we have the fall of the Western Roman Empire in 476, which frees the papacy from the temporal power of Roman civil authorities. So the two most powerful bishops of Rome prior to the 5th century are Leo the First and Gregory the First. Leo is thought to be, by some, the first real pope, because he was the first bishop of Rome to receive imperial recognition by the Roman emperor as the universal head of the church. But we say the first real pope is Gregory the First. What was Augustine's contribution to the development of the papacy? Who remembers? Right, his book, The City of God, which showed a universal Christian empire with one head of the church. Who sent missionaries to convert Britain? Gregory the First, the first pope. I want to summarize some other type of information here. What do you know about the Council of Nicaea? Who can give me some facts about it? Candy, what do you know about it? Condemned Arianism? Okay. Let me just go down the rows. What else can you remember about it?
Called by Constantine.
Called by Constantine? What does that show, Monica? Called by Constantine. What does that fact show? Right, it's called by an emperor rather than the pope. How many bishops were present? Do you remember? No, 318. Were most of them from the west or the east, Shelley? Nicaea. If you divide the empire, you know, right here, were most of them from over here or most of them from the east? No, most of them are from the east. This is important because you see that the theology basically comes from this part of the empire. We're real early in church history. Christianity started way down here in Palestine, so the majority of Christians are in the eastern part of the empire. Rome is the only major city in the west, and there were only five bishops from the whole western half. All the rest are from the eastern half. What word relative to the nature of Jesus did the creed contain? Okay, almost. Homoousios. It means what?
One substance.
Good. What's another way to translate homoousios? Right here.
Oh, I'm not sure.
Homoousios. Homo means what?
One person?
No. One substance, but there's another way that you could translate it. What do you think, Brian? Homoousios. Homo means what? What's it mean with regard to sexuality? Same. Okay, so you could translate it same substance, because homosexuals are two people of the same sex. What does heterousios mean, Brian?
Different.
Different, right. Different substance. And then, here's the tricky one. What does homoiousios mean? Homoiousios. H-O-M-O-I. Okay, that's a really good guess. It means... No, it is, because he's thinking. Shows he's thinking. One means like or identical, same substance. The other one means different. And so he says blend. Well, that was Eutychianism, remember? But that's not this word. Homoiousios means like substance. Now, which group wanted the creed to say homoousios, identical, same substance? They're talking about Jesus and the Father. And so they say, homoousios, he's absolutely identical in all respects to the Father. Pardon me? The Arians? No, the Arian wouldn't say absolutely identical, would he? Why wouldn't an Arian, just go, keep going here. Why wouldn't an Arian say absolutely identical in all respects? Right. But he also, with regard to the Trinity, did he believe that Jesus was homoousios, absolutely identical? No. What word would an Arian want? Heterousios, different? Or would he want homoiousios, like? Or would he want homoousios, identical?
Hetero.
Hetero, right. That's the one the Arians wanted. Who would want homoiousios, like substance?
That would be the majority
party. Right, the majority party in the middle.
Could you explain again why the Arians would want heterousios?
Heterousios, because they believed he was created rather than eternal. And so the Arians argued for the word heterousios, a different substance.
Didn't they say that he was exactly like God in it?
In all respects, with except his creation. No. Well, yes and no. They have a hard. That's a hard position to hold, because they believe that the Father created a person of God, not a human person, and so with regard to his Godhead, he's created, not just his humanity. And so it's hard to say, this is a person of God, and this is a person of God. He's an eternal person of God, and he's a created person of God. That's a real hard position to hold. In fact, none of these words really would fit it, except maybe homoiousios. He certainly is different if he is created. It has to be that way, and that's what they that's why homoiousios was such a big point at the Council of Nicaea. Who was exiled and banished from the Council of Nicaea afterward? Arius. Why?
The reason that Arius was exiled because he wouldn't give up his position.
Okay. They tried to make him do something and he wouldn't do it. What wouldn't he do?
Recant.
Yes, that's true. They excommunicated him because he refused to do something. Everybody else did it. He wouldn't. Do you remember what that was? Sign the creed. They made everybody sign their names and he refused. There were 5,000 people at the Council of Nicaea. Where is Nicaea? Doug? It's in Asia Minor. Right. It's way up here on the northwest corner. It's kind of by Constantinople, but it's on the other side of this Sea of Marmara. It's a little big lake like in here. It's like Puget Sound, you know, it's an inlet. And it's right on there. In fact, it's on a lake. I don't know the name of that lake, but... What happened to the creed which they wrote at Nicaea? Something happened to it later. Do you remember what that is, Jane?
They added a couple of words.
Right. They edited it and they added some sections to it. When did they add the sections, John? 381, the Council of Constantinople. Okay, here are some harder questions. Give me the definition of Gnosticism. What is Gnosticism? Just define it.
I just wrote this down last night.
Okay, say the belief in...
The belief in knowledge is higher...
Belief in a higher form of knowledge. Good. Okay, and give me one more characteristic of Gnosticism, Mike. Gnosticism, the higher form of knowledge, and they had one feature to this. They denied something. What did they deny?
They denied their natural affections. They denied their...
That's part of it.
Their human, like, food and clothing.
Right, asceticism. But that's true. They did deny that. That comes from a more basic belief, though. And what's that? That matter is evil, and therefore they practiced asceticism. Man is saved by attaining some secret knowledge. Now, if matter is evil, how does that affect the doctrine of Christ to a Gnostic?
Christ didn't have a human body.
Right. Christ didn't have a human body. And what doctrine does that affect, Monica? There's several doctrines that you could say it affects. If Jesus didn't have a body, what happened on the cross? Yes, okay. It would affect the doctrine of Christology, that's for sure. What other doctrine would it affect, Jan? Yes, it would affect the doctrine of the death of Christ on the cross, right? The atonement. The Bible teaches that we're saved by what? Grace through faith. But we have faith in something. What was necessary for Jesus on the cross to have in order for us to have atonement and salvation? Shelley, what did he have to do on the cross? Yes. Let's see, I didn't ask you the right question I'm trying to ask. The Bible says, without the what, there is no forgiveness of sins. Without the what? There's a something that happened on the cross. I'm groping for the right way to ask this question. Without a body, Jesus had no
blood.
Right. Okay. Define Arianism for me. The belief that what?
The Son was created.
Good. He's not eternal. He's a person of God who was created. Define Apollinarianism for me. That's a harder one. These are the harder ones. That's the belief that Jesus had no human soul or spirit. He's just God in a body. Define Eutychianism. That's a harder one, again. That's the one where Jesus, his human and divine natures were blended so as to produce a new third nature. Let's see. Define Logos Christology. Right. Right. Define Monarchianism. Yes, the belief in one God manifested in several persons. Define Nestorianism. The truth. It's the closest to what we believe of any of them. Okay, it's the belief that Christ had two persons as well as two natures combined in one flesh. Define Trinitarianism, Craig.
The belief that God is one and three, but two. one God, but he is made up of three distinct separate persons.
Right. One God who is made up of three persons. That's a good way to say it. Tell me whether Trinitarians believe these things. Jesus is one person with two natures. Yes or no?
Yeah.
Okay, you're right. Jesus is one person with two wills. Okay, be quiet. Let's just go down the rows. Yes, they believe that. One person, two natures, two wills. Okay. Mary is the mother of God.
According to the creeds.
According to the creeds, true.
But most Trinitarians, Protestants, don't believe that.
Yeah, if you talk to the average Trinitarian on the street, they don't even understand these things. You know, they're hard enough for us, and we're trying to study them hour after hour. And, you know, I mean, seriously, the average Trinitarian doesn't understand it. let's see. How do I ask this? Define monophysitism.
It's the belief that there was one nature.
Right, one nature, monophysitism. Now, does the Trinitarian affirm monophysitism or deny the one nature? Jesus had one nature. Does the Trinitarian say that's wrong or say that's right? Monophysitism would say one person with one nature. Okay, they would say that's wrong. They'd say there's one person with two natures. Define monothelitism, John.
When Christ had two wills, that they were fused into one.
Almost. Okay, Christ had one will. Mono means one, and thelo means will. Now, would a Trinitarian say that's right or wrong?
A Trinitarian would say that.
Monothelitism would be one will.
Say that.
That's wrong. Yes, the Trinitarian position is this. That's the Trinitarian view of Jesus.
I thought they said that even though they were two, though, they were really fused into one.
Well, they disagree with each other. That's the problem. We're talking the creeds now.
And the creeds are the two separate wills that mm-hmm.
Oh, yes, God, that's right. Yeah, one will is divine and the other will is human, but they say the human will is subordinate to the divine will. Okay, just a couple more things. Who was the leader of the majority party at the Council of Nicaea? They took the middle ground. Oh, let's see, Mike? At Nicaea, I realize these questions are hard, but it's good. It's good to talk about it. Council of Nicaea, you've got three parties. One of them is the biggest. Most people are there. It's kind of the compromise middle ground party.
Eusebius,
right. Eusebius of Caesarea. Good for you. Okay. I was going to say it for you. Okay. And then who's the leader of the Arian party?
Arian.
Good. Who else is an Arian? Who else was an Arian at the council? It's another Eusebius. Do you remember him? Eusebius of Nicomedia is his name. Who led the Trinitarian party? Monica? Well, let's see. Think about Arius. Who did Arius oppose? It would be the man that Arius had disagreements with. That would be one of them. Do you remember him? In Alexandria? Arius was a pastor down there in Alexandria, and he was preaching about Christ, and somebody got upset about it. And they talked about it in their churches. And it was Alexander, the bishop of Alexandria. He was the bishop over all the pastors, and Arius was a pastor under him. Which means Arius was a Trinitarian pastor of a Trinitarian congregation. Early Trinitarians, you know, the Logos Christology type. And so he's not, you know, a big heretic, at least until the Council of Nicaea. He's a regular pastor of a Trinitarian church. Okay. Which council denied Arianism? Right, Nicaea. Good. It condemned Arianism. Which council condemned Apollinarianism? That'd be the belief that Jesus is not fully human. Right. Good for you. That's a hard one. Constantinople. Which council denied Nestorianism? Ephesus. Good. Which council denied Eutychianism? Right. Pronounced with a hard CH, so Chalcedon. Which one denied monophysitism? That's a harder one, because there's two more that we didn't study much. And you have Constantinople the second and Constantinople the third. And the second, it denied monophysitism. And Constantinople the third denied monothelitism. Okay. Tell me what belief this is. Christ is homoousios with the Father. Who believes that? I'm past Brian. Yes. Christ is. Trinitarian would believe that. Who believes this? Mary was the mother of the human person Christ, not the mother of God. No, an Arian wouldn't believe that. Right, a oneness person would believe that. A oneness person would believe that. Who else would believe that? Mary was the mother of the human person Christ, not the mother of God. Right, Nestorius and the Nestorians. Okay, here's a harder one. God is one ousia with three hypostases. That is, God is one being in three distinct persons. Who believes that? Trinitarians, right. Give me another leader of the Orthodox party at the Council of Nicaea. Mm-hmm. The emperor? Oh, okay, you could say that. He didn't really lead the theological discussion. Athanasius, good. So we have Alexander, Athanasius, and then the representative of the Pope. Do you remember who his name is? Hosius, good, of Cordova. He's from Spain, a Spanish bishop. There's one more man that we didn't talk much about in history. Let me bring up his name, okay? With regard to the Godhead. You need to take this down in your notes because we didn't cover this yet. His name is Callistus. Callistus. Callistus was the bishop of Rome in the 200s when Sabellius was teaching monarchianism there. And he offered a compromise doctrine between monarchianism or Sabellianism and Logos Christology. But he's the bishop of Rome. In other words, he's viewed as a pope. He wasn't a real strong Trinitarian, though. He did excommunicate Sabellius from the church as a heretic, the Bishop of Rome. We also have another man in history with regard to the Godhead named Hippolytus. Hippolytus. And Hippolytus was another man who taught Logos Christology. He also was a teacher in Rome. And he was charged by the Bishop of Rome with believing in two gods. He taught that the Father and Son were distinct from each other, which is kind of like what a Trinitarian would teach, except he made a drastic separation between them, and so the Bishop of Rome charged him with being a heretic and said that he believed in two gods instead of two persons who were part of the one God. Other main characters regarding the Godhead would be Origen, O-R-I-G-E-N. He's famous because he was the head of the University of Alexandria, a prolific writer. He popularized the allegorical method of interpreting. He believed Christ was a second God generated by the Father. And so today, Origen is viewed as a heretic with regard to his Christology. He didn't believe Christ and the Father were homoousios. He believed he was a second God. And then, of course, we have Tertullian, the converted Stoic lawyer, the first man to use the term Trinity. He was a follower of Logos Christology. Athanasius, he's another leader, the deacon who carried the main argument for the Trinity at the Council of Nicaea. Sabellius, a 3rd century monarchian who was excommunicated for heresy. Of course, Alexander, the Bishop of Alexandria who opposed Arius. Eusebius of Caesarea, who offered his creed, used in his own church, to the Council of Nicaea. In fact, his creed became the basic Nicene Creed. It was just edited a little bit. Then Eusebius of Nicomedia, the Arian, he justified signing the creed, condemning his own views by holding a mental reservation. And I suppose that you could say Constantine was a factor because he called the Council of Nicaea. Then you have Hosius, who presided over the theological discussions at the council. He's the representative of the Pope and one of the bishops from the West. Eusebius of Caesarea, the leader of the majority party, and then Arius of Alexandria. Those are the main men in history that pertain to these issues. Yes? Okay, by Pope I mean the Bishop of Rome. Okay, that's all the material that I'm going to summarize. As far as your test goes, you need to know a few other things. You should study these things in addition to what I've taught you already by summary. You should study what names are used in the Bible to describe the early church. They're called believers, brethren, Christians, disciples, saints, sect of the Nazarenes, those of this way, etc. And why Rome considered Christianity a threat, claimed to be the only true religion, denying the reality of all pagan gods. It proselytized heavy, divided homes, refused to worship the emperor, giving him divine honor. It didn't allow believers to participate in all the public festivals. It prohibited members from involvement in politics and the military, and it even affected businesses in Rome. So, imperial persecutions began under Nero, and you had 10 main persecutors. The worst ones were Decius and Diocletian. There are 5 great centers of Christianity: Alexandria, Antioch, Constantinople, Jerusalem, and Rome. And then study the word church and what it means and how it's used in the Bible. Okay. Now, with that, I want to start the next period of church history. Yes? The only thing I want you to know about Rome is that the first real Roman emperor was Augustus Caesar, you know, in the modern sense of a Roman emperor. And then you need to know which emperors persecuted the church. Okay, so let's start the next section now of church history. We want to study the medieval church. That's spelled M-E-D-I-E-V-A-L. Medieval. 590 to 1517. Now, this is pictured in the book of Revelation as the church of Thyatira, typified by the church of Thyatira in the Apocalypse, where we find the consequences of the Pergamos marriage or union. We just studied the Pergamos church, which means the church got married to heathenism, to the world. And so you see a union or a mixture of worldly philosophy and Christianity. And it resulted in the theological errors, which we just studied, plunging the church into the Dark Ages, and Roman Catholicism reached its zenith. You can study Miller's Church History, pages 291 to 295, for an allegorical interpretation of Revelation 2, 18 to 29. The letter to this church of Thyatira by Jesus shows the features that we're going to study. There are two classes of persons addressed by the Lord in Revelation 2. The first is Jezebel's children. They're in verse 23, Revelation 2:23. And then second, there are overcomers who resisted her. And they're in verses 24 to 26. Now, the fact that Jesus mentioned the overcomers who resisted this harlot and her system shows that there were true believers in Christ during this period of history. We know there were true believers who served Jesus, even though they are not very visible historically. This is from 590 to 1517. Notice that's about 1,000 years. And this is why we say, when the Roman Catholic system was in power, it ruled the world for 1,000 years of darkness. 590 to 1517. Now, this period of church history consists of several distinct movements. I cited these already. We'll take them one at a time. You have Islam, papal authority and degradation, monasticism, the Crusades, and pre-Reformation movements. So we'll study them one at a time. Number one, Islam. Or Islam. I-S-L-A-M. This is another name for Mohammedanism, or the religion preached by the Prophet Mohammed. Islam would be defined as the religion preached by the Prophet Mohammed in the AD 600s. So Islam is a late date religion. It did not begin with Jesus Christ, where Christianity did in AD 30. Nor did it begin with Moses the way Levitical Judaism did in 1500. And of course, it didn't begin with the true worship of God like God's holy religion did. I don't know what the name for that one would be, back in the Garden of Eden. This is a late date religion. It's kind of like Reverend Moon's religion, or Joseph Smith, or Brigham Young, or one of the other founders of these Christian cults, so-called. Mohammed was an Arab who was born in Mecca, which is in Arabia, about AD 570. He believed he'd been sent to warn and guide his people and call them to worship God. They called God Allah, A-L-L-A-H. Allah is an Arabic word. Arabic, of course, is the Arabian language. You can see the closeness between these Semitic-type languages because in the Hebrew, most of you are aware, there is a word, Elah, E-L-A-H, and it is the word for God used in the Bible. Well, they have Elah. Arabic has Allah. It's the same word, really. It's just their way of saying it. Allah, though, is not truly the God of the Bible. Muhammad preached that there is only one God, Allah. He did not divide God into three persons. Allah is one person. And he said that he, Muhammad, was God's messenger. Everybody who believes in Allah will accept Muhammad as his messenger, according to the theory. And they're all called Muslims. Now the word Muslim, M-O-S-L-E-M, Muslim. Sometimes it's pronounced Muslim, M-U-S-L-I-M. Muslim or Muslim means one who submits. And so Islam means submission. Muslim is the person, one who submits. Islam is the name of the religion, and it's called submission. Westerners often call it Mohammedanism, because, and the followers, Mohammedans. And they have the wrong, you get the wrong idea from this. You say, Mohammedanism, they believe in Mohammedanism. They are Mohammedans, meaning followers of Mohammed, which is true, but it misleads people to think that there's a god named Mohammed and they worship this god named Mohammed. That's not true. Mohammed is a man, and he was like a prophet of God, and he told the people to believe in God named Allah. So Muslims do not worship Mohammed. They worship Allah. Muslims feel the words Mohammedanism and Mohammedans give the wrong impression that Muslims worship Mohammed when they do not. And they're very sensitive about this. So they like to be called Muslims, and they like their religion to be called Islam. Now, Saudi Arabia is the modern name of this country. This is a very big nation. It's kind of like between the Mississippi River and the Atlantic Ocean. That chunk of the United States is about how big it is. And although it's that large, it has no natural creeks, rivers, or lakes. Think about that. Would you like to live in a nation like that? This is a big desert. It's quite different than where you and I live. Now, the religion of Islam is primarily in the Middle East. It's over there in Arabia, Pakistan, North Africa, Turkey. And there's one more place in the world there where there is a large population of Muslims. Who knows where that is? It's kind of unusual, in my opinion. Anyone? Yes? Russia? Okay, well, that's still kind of over in this part of the world. It would just be farther north. It's in Indonesia. Way over there, you know, in the ocean, kind of by Japan. I've never found out why they are over there. There's a huge population of them in Indonesia for some reason. Now, Islam teaches one God. It teaches angels, belief in angels, the resurrection of the body. In other words, all the righteous and unrighteous are going to be resurrected. Everybody is. There will be a great judgment. Muhammad was the last of the prophets. And they teach the authority of Scripture. Their religious book is called the Quran. K-O-R-A-N. Most of you have probably heard about this book. It is their Bible. It forbids the images of man or animals. Now, what happened was this. The companions of Muhammad preserved his revelations by memorizing them or writing them down during his lifetime. Muslim scholars believe Muhammad approved these teachings. Later, all the materials were combined to form the holy book called the Quran. The word Quran means recitation. The first official edition of the Quran came out about 650 AD. So it's right around his own lifetime. And it's been edited and so forth till modern times. Muslims view the Quran as the words of God himself, spoken to Muhammad by an angel. Portions of the book resemble the Bible. Other portions resemble the Apocrypha, and even other portions are like the Talmud or Jewish writings. The Quran contains many stories about the prophets that appear in the Old Testament, but they are other stories than the ones the Bible has. They're about the same people, though, like Abraham. The Quran also has some stories from the New Testament about Jesus Christ, and it calls Jesus Christ the Logos of God. And so you see this same error here. Jesus is the Logos. Islam has a very strict form of morality, and it is legalistic to the extreme. If you talk about legalism, this is the embodiment of it. Can't you see that by the name of it? Who would name their religion submission, you know? Isn't that the demon of legalism? Of course it is. He's saying, submit, 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 submit. You know, well, the Bible does teach submission, but not like that. It's very strict morality against lying, stealing, adultery, murder. In the religion, punishment is based on the law. An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. And so some of you have heard Pastor tell stories about this, and maybe even Debbie Stutzman, who traveled in these lands and even went to school there and even taught there for a while, tell stories that she heard about people in those lands and how they treat each other. Public beheadings are common. And also beatings for crimes, amputations for crimes. In other words, in Arabia today, in some parts where when people are caught stealing, they cut their hand off. And that's just the way they do it. So Pastor said, he told a story once, and I can't remember how this was, but somehow somebody lost their wallet in one of those cities, and they came back 3 days later, and it was still laying in the street. Nobody touched it. Now, would that happen in America? In America, they reach into your pocket and take it out, you know. The Quran permits slavery under certain conditions, and it teaches salvation by works. Islam teaches that life on earth is a period of testing and preparation for the life to come. They say the angels of God write down all of man's good deeds and bad deeds. A person, therefore, should try his best to be good and help others, and also trust in God's justice and mercy to be rewarded in the afterlife. Death is like a gate to eternal life and happiness. Muslims believe that at the last day, everyone will be resurrected, all the righteous and all the unrighteous, on the great day of judgment. And then everyone will appear before Allah. Allah will read the books. He'll have the book of the record of the good deeds and the book of the record of the bad deeds. And if you've done a lot of good deeds, there's a little book that has all your good deeds in it, and Allah will hand you your book. He puts it in your right hand, according to the teaching, and then you get to go to heaven. If you live wickedly, a book containing all the list of the wicked things you did is placed in your left hand, and then you go to hell and suffer eternally forever. The sorrows and tortures of hell are just like those described in the lake of fire in the Bible. The Muslim heaven is a garden with flowing streams, luscious fruits, richly covered couches, beautiful maidens, and lots of pillows on the floor. And so, you know, you can see that their heaven is like what would be the very best thing to them in their society. Now, Muslim duties have, a lot of water. Muslim duties are to pray 5 times a day. Dawn, noon, afternoon, evening, and nightfall. And no matter where they are in the world, they turn and face Mecca. And they recite passages of the Quran and repeat the same praise to Allah. And so a Muslim will have a prayer rug, and he'll unroll his prayer rug, and he'll kneel down, literally kneel down like this,
on his knees, and then they bow like this to Mecca, and they pray to Allah and put their head on the prayer mat.
And they do that 5 times a day. Now, what demon is that? That's legalism again. Now, God wants you to pray. So what do? They make a law, see? Pray 5 times a day. Face Mecca, you know, and that's that demon again. It's coming right out in this religion. Also, almsgiving. Almsgiving means doing good deeds, like giving money to the poor. Number 3, fasting. In fact, they fast 1 month a year. 30 days out of the year. Now, not all together, of course, you know, day after day after day for a month, but they don't. Now, by fasting, they mean they don't eat from dawn to sunset. And then, number 4, a pilgrimage to Mecca. The Quran commands every faithful follower to go to Mecca. And so one time in their life, a Muslim will put all of his money into this trip, and he will go to Mecca. I should have brought this photograph I have. I'm not even sure I can find it. I'll try. Of millions of Muslims in Mecca. It was in National Geographic, and it was an amazing photograph. Some of you may have seen it. It was a photograph of this huge sea of people on this road on the way into Mecca. And it looked like millions of people. And there were buses. And there were hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of buses all over the roads and on the edges. And there's this road, and then there's these buses all around it, and it's a real deserty area, and these millions of people all dressed in white, and they're all headed into Mecca. It's an incredible photograph during their holy days. So those are the 4 things they do. Pray, give alms, fast, and make one pilgrimage to Mecca. They worship in mosques, M-O-S-Q-U-E-S. And the leader of the religion is called the Imam, I-M-A-M, the Imam. It's divided into sects, just like Christianity. You know, we have the Presbyterians and the Methodists and the Lutherans and the Catholics and Protestants. Well, Islam is like that too. They're not all unified. There's all kinds of sects. For example, a famous one today is the Shiite Muslim. S-H-I-I-T-E-S. It's a certain denomination of Muslim. Another one is Sunnites. S-U-N-N-I-T-E-S. Now, allegedly, the story goes like this. Mohammed had the angel Gabriel appear unto him. Mohammed was a young man. He was in a cave, meditating alone. And an angel from heaven named Gabriel appears and calls him to launch a new dispensation. Now, does that sound familiar? Who does it sound familiar to? Joseph Smith, the founder of the Mormons. Now, Gautama Buddha had the same thing happen to him. And so did Reverend Moon. He was praying on a hillside, and Jesus appeared to him and called him to launch a new dispensation. Now, we cite Galatians 1, 8, and 9. If we or an angel from heaven preach any other gospel unto you than that which we have preached, let him be accursed. Muslims say that at first, Mohammed doubted that the vision came from God. In which case, I would say, it may not be a true vision. And he set out to destroy idolatry in Arabia. His religion spread very slowly at first, and he had a great deal of persecution. He began preaching in Mecca about 610 and made slow progress. Most of the rich and powerful people in Mecca scorned him and his preaching. He was thought to be an outcast, kind of a religious fanatic. And his preaching angered and frightened the Meccans. Some of them even plotted to kill him. After 12 years, he fled in 622. fled Mecca, and he went to a city called Medina, M-E-D-I-N-A. And a group of people there took him in and began to help him. And this emigration to Medina is a very famous thing to the Muslims. Okay, we'll stop there. Okay, so tomorrow we'll have a test. And then next week we'll start studying in this section of history.
Was he or his family, were they Christian?
No, they were just following Arabic religion. I'm not sure what it's called.
I got to witness to him here a couple months ago.
Mm-hmm.
And the things that shocked him were, number one, I shared how I was oneness and not Trinitarian.
Uh-huh.
Said, you're kidding. You're a Christian,
mm-hmm.
and you don't believe in three God.
Yeah.
And then it was grace. And he kept